we're learning how Indigenous culture and storytelling inform architecture and design. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Milwaukee architect Chris Cornelius is a citizen of the Oneida Nation, working to elevate Indigenous values in architecture. He says when Native Americans see the land, they often tell stories. These stories are forever embedded in the landscape, and we can look at buildings through this lens. Are you an architect or designer? Do you find inspiration in the land, in nature, or storytelling? What does decolonizing architecture mean to you? It's 800-642-1234. Chris Cornelius was formerly an architecture professor at UW-Milwaukee, recently named chair of the Department of Architecture at the University of New Mexico School of Architecture and Planning, and founding principal of a design and consulting practice serving American Indian clients. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's go back to the elementary school on the reservation you grew up on. Designed in the shape of a turtle, the elementary school built in the 90s. How does that inform how you see Indigenous culture and architecture kind of colliding today?
Well, I didn't attend that school, but I, you know, watched its development on the reservation, and it struck me that that particular form, while it's important to our culture, doesn't necessarily say anything. Like, the building itself doesn't help you understand why the turtle is important. It looks like a giant turtle. It's got the gym is in the head, and it has eyes made of tiles on the exterior, and it's a very important symbol, but it doesn't make it experiential. And that was my reaction to it, you know, as I was starting graduate school at the University of Virginia. And at that time, I thought, well, there has to be a better way to do this for Indigenous people. There has to be a better way to serve them through architecture, and that the architecture itself can begin to teach people about the culture and make that experiential. It's the, you know, the thing that architecture can do for us is to bring experiences and even material strategies and understandings of culture that other things can't.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that gets at a little bit about how you think about how things are related and the relationality of things as a designer, and especially in how buildings form and what materials, what words you choose. Can you introduce us to that concept of relationality?
Sure. We often hear Indigenous people speak of the earth as our mother, right? Mother Earth, Father Sky, stones are our grandfathers, the moon is our grandmother. And that terminology is really indicative of how we think about these things, meaning in a familial way, that we're actually related to these things. And I think that that notion and or concept, while it has a deep meaning for Indigenous people, for non-Indigenous people, if we started thinking about things in that way, especially the earth and our familial relationships with it, we would think about them differently. And I include buildings in that. We hadn't talked about buildings as being part of that relation. And I think that if we started to think about that in a relational way, let's say it's our cousins or something like that, we would begin to really think about how is it situated on the site? What is it doing with its neighbors? When I'm designing these things, when I'm putting them into the world and I have responsibility for that, am I thinking about the materials I put into that building? Where is that building going to be in 100 years? Will it still be there, or will it be in a landfill or something else? Will it become something else? And so I try to think about those things and as much as I can. And not only the materials, but who made those materials? Who's installing those materials? All of the sort of life of the thing itself from beginning to end, can I begin to think about those things? And it's that familial relationship that's important to think about. And that is intentional so that we have responsibilities to those things in the ways that we would our own family members.
Sounds like as these buildings, these structures take on, you know, they're living and breathing, and there's a permanence to them. I mean, you really think about how this building will be in this landscape, you know, a century from now.
Right. So buildings do live, breathe, they sweat, they produce waste. They can make us sick, they can make us healthy, right? They can sustain us, or they can hurt us. So we meaning that they can either be a predator or a prey. And so I think that if we thought about those issues when we're creating buildings, architecture, and enclosed experiences, we would think about them in a way that we should be thinking about the responsibilities and relationship we have with that thing.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Chris Cornelius, who is an architect and is the new chair of the Department of Architecture at the University of New Mexico School of Architecture and Planning. You can join in about how architecture influences you and what does decolonizing architecture look like to you. Have you been to the Indian Community School in Milwaukee? What are your thoughts on its design? Join in at 800-642-1234. Chris, your father worked as a brick mason. Family members worked in construction. How did the family influences influence you to become an architect?
I was always around building because of that. And my father, who worked very hard. Always knew that he got up very early in the morning and he came home exhausted. And sometimes I got the opportunity to go with him to these job sites and things. But I really started to get fascinated by the fact that someone designed what they were working on. Someone drew it, that this sometimes it was a house, sometimes it was something else, some other commercial building. That someone had designed that. And I got really fascinated with the drawings, blueprints, and things like that. And so that was a very, at a very, very early age, I would say 9 or 10. And it wasn't until like middle school that I really started to decide, well, this is the path for me. This is the thing that I want to do. And that's where I kind of started and got this notion of building was just from my father and his brothers, who were in the construction industry.
And you don't just love drawing. You really love drawing. I wonder if we could peek into your sketchbook and what happens to you when you're drawing and working in your sketchbook.
I often say that for me, drawing is medicine. And so in indigeneity, we talk about a lot of people say, well, beading is medicine or basket making is medicine. So the craft work of making a thing and putting it into the world is part of the thing that makes you better and makes others around you better. So for me, when I'm drawing, it's about being able to articulate things that I couldn't in any other way. Meaning, if I can't say it, I can only think it. I might be able to dream it. And so all of those are forms of knowledge in indigenous culture. We value dreams and hallucinations and visions and other sorts of things as part of that knowledge. And so for me, when I'm drawing, it's not always just about drawing a designed object. I think in architecture, we tend to focus more on like the conception of the thing in your mind, and then you're trying to represent it from there, right? That you start to do drawings, you might do a scale model of it. And for me, those activities can be a part of the making of the thing, meaning sometimes when I'm drawing, I don't know what it's going to be. Sometimes when I sit down to draw, I don't know what the end result is actually going to be. But I do know that it's in the process and ritual of drawing that something will come out. And so this notion of like a sort of creative writer's block for me is not a thing because I can kind of draw myself out of any of those sort of obstacles. And so when I do draw, I like to draw in ways that aren't just describing the thing. I might be trying to draw and describe senses and feelings and immaterial things. Can I draw like Wi-Fi signals, or can I draw insects flying around a thing, or can it be any of those things? And so for me, that's how I think about drawing. It's how I've taught students how to think about drawing as well.
Really, their relation on this earth and what is around them. I'm just curious, do you erase your lines? Do you use an eraser?
I haven't used an eraser to erase lines since like 2003. I decided not to use an eraser. So I was an artist in residence for the National Museum of the American Indian, and I was doing this residency, and I was in New York City. And I started drawing, like, okay, this is what I proposed to make drawings of my tribe's creation story. And I started to work on my sketchbook. And then I realized that in the process of drawing, if I erase something, I'm like basically taking an idea back out of the world. And so I started to really draw how we think, meaning when you first have initial thoughts, they might be not clear or resolute in some way. And so what I did do is I started drawing over that. Instead of erasing it or like turning the page and starting a new drawing, I would just draw over that. And what I realized was that the initial thought that I had that I wasn't as convinced of, I can draw over that, meaning I can draw darker. I might start to use watercolors on it. And the other thing recedes into the drawing, but it becomes part of its life. And so I stopped erasing, you know, back then when I started doing that. Then I realized as I was drawing that we don't really need to erase certain things, at least in that type of drawing.
Yeah.
For me, I just stopped erasing.
We're looking at the iterations of architect and educator Chris Cornelius, explaining how his drawings pay respect to the land, to nature, indigenous narratives. What do you want to know about the design process of architecture? What do you think the architecture and design world could learn from First Nations? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Cornelius here on the Ideas Network. We're at the intersection of Indigenous history and culture and how contemporary architecture and design can become more respectful of the natural world and Native voices. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Architect Chris Cornelius is a citizen of the United Nations. He approaches design as ceremony. Design is medicine. It's not a task. It has rituals like drawing, as we've been talking about, bearing the responsibility for putting structures into the world and how they interact with the world. What do you want to know about Indigenous architecture? What do you want to know about the design process? 800-642-1234. Architecture professor and principal of his design firm, Chris Cornelius, stays with us. Chris, you started your firm, Studio Indigenous, in 2003. What does it mean to be an Indigenous designer that serves Indigenous clients?
I think it's about responsibility for the built environment. I think that design has not particularly served Indigenous people well. And for me, that means that what I'm producing are the contemporary artifacts of the culture. While the culture hasn't changed for tens of thousands of years, the artifacts that we put into the world have. And we haven't really been talking about, meaning as Indigenous people, we haven't been talking about architecture, even though it was part of our culture. Building was always a part of our culture. The materials we used, the ceremonies that went around building those things, and that the buildings themselves were active participants in ceremonies and culture. And so I realized that what I wanted to do was to kind of help fill that void, meaning the connection between culture and architecture, and how can it specifically serve Indigenous people, and how can we begin to think about even the built form and landscape of our reservations, of our homelands, of how we exist within the world. And I wanted to do that, to help serve Indigenous people.
Do you think your clients treat you differently or reveal things to you they might not otherwise?
Probably. I think that, you know, when I work with Indigenous communities, I feel like they understand that while I'm Indigenous, I don't belong to the specific culture that they are. But I do think that we speak a kind of language, meaning I know how to understand the culture. And so many times projects really come from stories and ideas from the people that I'm working with. I don't try to approach things with preconceived notions about what I think it should be for those people. But I do find that in conversation, someone will tell me what's important, right? Like someone will tell me about a story that's really important to them. And oftentimes I like to actually start with the tribe's creation story. How does that particular story begin to tell you about how they exist in the landscape and how they see the landscape? It usually does. And so how do we begin to do that? Because I think that, you know, I realized early on too that a single building cannot encapsulate the entire culture. We're only making specific statements about parts of the culture. And so it's in those stories that I think I find inspiration, because they do tell us about the importance of the culture in the landscape. And that's what architecture is trying to do. I think we're trying to reconcile ourselves with the earth. And it's a way for us to begin to do that.
And those stories, they also come out in powerful ceremonies and just, you know, the power of ceremony. And I'm thinking about powwows in particular. How do you think about regalia and the sacred dress at ceremonial events, and how regalia influences architecture, perhaps in the materials you use?
Well, regalia is important to understand that it's something that is not just aesthetic, meaning it's not just about its physical appearance, even though that is one of its roles. It can tell you other things. It can tell you where that person is from. What clan are they within in that nation? And then how do those things then connect them to that clan, meaning usually an animal. How do they interact with the world? And so I began to think that, well, architecture could have regalia as well. And so I started to do that in some of the installation work that I've done, temporary installations, one in Columbus, Indiana, then the one at Bookworm Gardens in Sheboygan. And then I did another one at the Haggerty Museum as part of the Mary Knoll Fellowship. But I really think that, because in architecture, we think a lot about aesthetics. We think a lot about what we call ornament. And for me, regalia is hyper ornament, meaning it means more than just its sort of ornamental role. It can begin to stand for other things. And for me as a designer, when I'm putting these things onto these installations, I'm not trying to determine exactly what it is, meaning it doesn't always mean just one thing. It can have multiple meanings. And oftentimes I'm just trying to raise the question and awareness of regalia and how it's used how it can be used in architecture.
We're talking with Chris Cornelius, who is an architecture professor, a citizen of the United Nations, and founding principal of Studio Indigenous Design and Consulting Practice. We're looking at architecture through the lens of Indigenous culture. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Chris, you mentioned Trickster. You have this contemporary art installation called Trickster at the Bookworm Gardens in Sheboygan. Can you paint a picture for us what Trickster looks like?
It intentionally doesn't look like anything, to be honest. So it's I wanted it to be like, well, let me explain what the Trickster. Trickster in Indigenous culture, and it's not exclusive to Indigenous culture. I think other cultures have tricksters as well, but in the Indigenous culture, it's usually an animal. Sometimes it's some other phenomena, but it's there to teach us about our own humanity, meaning the trickster might do something. It's looking for vanity or some sort of valor or it might be about greed. The trickster might be eating a lot of things or not sharing or things like that. And so what I wanted to do at the Bookworm Gardens, because it's a children's literary garden, is to bring out that sort of role in storytelling. And so I wanted the children that were coming to the garden to be able to tell their own stories about the thing. So it doesn't look like a thing, right? It doesn't look like anything. And it also doesn't have any specific purpose. It could be kind of like a small pavilion or some other sort of thing that you could get into. But other than that, it doesn't specifically have a purpose. And because I'm intentionally trying to allow the trickster, because it's a thing that I can then speak through, to allow the trickster begin to explain its own role in the world and what that might be. And so that it's meant that people are putting those responsibilities and roles on it. And because the trickster in the storytelling, it's usually a device by the storyteller to be able to teach you lessons. And that's how the culture is taught, through these stories, and to be able to teach you lessons about how you're supposed to conduct yourself, how you might interact with other people, and it's done in a sort of entertaining way, but to begin to teach you those kinds of lessons.
We're spending the hour with architect and professor Chris Cornelius on how Indigenous culture informs his work in the world. How do you think Indigenous communities and a new generation of architects could change the way buildings are built and be compatible with nature? How do you think skylines would change if there were more architects from underrepresented communities? How has architecture and design moved you? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with Chris Cornelius after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're discussing how Indigenous stories, culture, history inform an architect's vision for the world. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee architect Chris Cornelius started his firm Studio Indigenous nearly 2 decades ago to serve Native American clients, as we've been talking about, and communities, because in his personal experience and upbringing, design had not served them well. What does decolonizing architecture look like to you? What do you want to know about Indigenous architecture? Join in 800-642-1234. Architect and Professor Chris Cornelius is with us for the hour. Let's bring in Tom now in Burlington. Hi, Tom. What are your thoughts?
Well, I have a couple of thoughts. It's all right. First, I live in a California-style house, which is designed like Frank Lloyd Wright, with these big overhang things that, you know, how his houses are designed. And it's not really practical in this weather with the wind, with the heavy snow on these things. But and Frank would try to design his houses to fit right into the landscape. And I'm sure you're familiar with all his famous things. But he, not only would he design the house, but he would design the carpeting, the furniture, the straight back chairs, which I think were very uncomfortable. But some of the other stuff was comfortable and human body friendly. But I also worked at the Washington Gallery of Art in Washington, which is a fancy name. The National Gallery of Art, people get the Washington Gallery of Art confused with the National Gallery. And Gloria Vanderbilt came, and she had her famous first showing of her artwork there. And she would make collages. She would cut little pictures out of the newspaper and then put them up on a canvas, and then she put shellac around them, and then she put a very fancy Rococo kind of frame around it. And that was her first showing, and from that she became famous. Then she started designing her famous jeans out of that, and that's how she got her little start.
Well,
Tom,
I just wanted to jump in here and to ask Chris about, what do you see Frank Lloyd Wright's influence on design and architecture and his thoughts about nature?
I think that, you know, to be honest, they're very similar to how, and I think, an Indigenous architect should think. And his work, well, for instance, if you've been to Taliesin East, you know, the Taliesin itself is a structure that's built on a hill, but he maintained the top of the hill in a really extraordinary way, because the exterior courtyard, you can actually stand on the top of the hill and the architecture is integrated with it. And he often did that through most of his buildings and work that he did, was that the thing was supposed to be sympathetic to the site. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, is that if we thought about that relationship as a familial relationship, that the architecture is actually related to the site. That's really kind of very similar. And the fact that, you know, he did design almost everything within a home, including the furniture, the furnishings, window shades, carpeting, everything, if he could. And I would too, if I could, as a designer, because I feel like those things within the building should be also related to the building, and in a aesthetic way.
Yeah, I want to talk more a little bit about aesthetics, because you were a cultural consultant and design collaborator for the design of the Indian Community School in Milwaukee. How did you translate Wisconsin's tribal cultures and values into that design?
So I worked with Antoine Predock, who is a world famous architect. He won the American Institute of Architects Gold Medal. He's won a number of awards and done work all over the world. And so when we first started looking at the project, I said, well, because the project is intended to be for all Wisconsin tribes and not any specific tribe, we can't get too specific about cultural things. But we can begin to look at how these particular cultures relate to one another. And they're similar in the sense that they're all sort of Eastern woodland tribes. Like my tribe, the Oneida, were indigenous to New York State. We're not indigenous to Wisconsin, while the Menominee are indigenous to Wisconsin. We have some similar values. And so that's where we started. We started with cultural values, and then we took those cultural values and made them into images. And we explained to the clients that these are the sort of 30 values that we wanted to be within the architecture. And we produced them on transparencies. We made these 3-foot by 4-foot large transparencies on a light box. And this is how we presented it to the community. Because those transparencies can overlay with one another, that's how we saw this working, that the cultural values overlay one another. So if oral tradition and dancing and burrowing and play, like all of those were cultural values that can come together, and that they can come together in different ways and at different values, meaning like not everything is of equal value. And so when we started to think about the building, in particular spaces, we would talk about those spaces through the lens of those cultural values. And then that would help us determine, like, what are the finishes that we're going to put into the building? How should people interact with it? How are they sitting? What are they touching? What are they seeing? All of those things were always tied to those cultural values.
I was really struck by the pillars that are actually trees. I mean, that was just, it was beautiful and sacred and very, very specific to what you were trying to accomplish there.
Right. And so because in indigeneity, we don't see nature as a commodity. We don't see nature as a resource for us to consume, meaning those trees were not intended to just like become lumber, for instance. Mm-hmm. The trees were brought down in ceremony. They're from the Menominee Nation, and the Menominee Nation has always sustainably harvested their trees. And so that in that ceremony, they were giving their lives to the school, and they're part of the school's life now, and they tell stories. Some of those trees are over 300 years old, and so they tell stories of pre-European contact. They are intended to be there as holders of stories and to begin to tell us things about the building. So the columns themselves, we did look at using them structurally, but they didn't. So there's actually a steel column that's taking the structural responsibilities. And then we had a Menominee artisan who split the trees and then clad them and put them together on the columns.
And taking the bark off. Yeah, because they're completely smooth and just beautiful, just so gorgeous. It's interesting, too, Chris, how, you know, a lobby isn't called a lobby. A cafeteria isn't a cafeteria. Can you kind of explain the naming conventions?
Sure. We, from the beginning, too, when we were doing the sort of programming for the building, meaning the uses and how those things go together, we wanted to strip all of the institutional names from it. The role of education to Indigenous people is very complicated, I would say. And so if it had a Facebook relationship status, it would be as complicated. Because education was used as a tool for colonization. It was used as a tool to assimilate Indigenous youth. And so we wanted to strip those sort of institutional names. So we never, ever called the place, and they still don't, and the school's been open for 14 years. They don't call that the place where they eat, the cafeteria, or where you come into the building is not the lobby. So the where they eat is called feast, and where you come in is called community, and the theater is called drum. So we don't call them those specific things. And so I think that that does a number of things. One, it ties it to the culture. So it ties space to culture. And then it forces us as users and the students and staff to always use those names. And those names, then you are aware of their importance. You're aware of how they are now indigenous spaces and not about institutional spaces that could be anywhere. And so we intentionally tried to use these cultural names for major spaces, and the students and staff still use those names.
Yeah, they certainly stuck. We're talking with Chris Cornelius, who is an architecture professor, a citizen of the United Nations, and looking at how design and architecture can live together with Native American philosophy and culture. With your questions as well along the way, what do you want to know about Indigenous architecture? What does decolonizing architecture look like to you? 800-642-1234 to join in. Let's talk a little bit about this class that you put together at Yale, Decolonizing Indigenous Housing. What does that mean?
So I was very fortunate to be the Lewis Icon visiting assistant professor at Yale. And so all of my students, this was an advanced graduate design studio. All my students were non-Indigenous. And so I had to begin to think about how am I going to teach this to non-Indigenous people. So the basic premise there is that something that I've been thinking about probably my whole career, and I'm starting to really address through my own designs, that design for Indigenous people, specifically related to housing, has never really served the Indigenous people, meaning that we don't see ourselves in the design. And so in that studio, what I was trying to do is to begin to teach the ways that we should be thinking about design for Indigenous people, using the house as the sort of laboratory or lens through which we would see architecture and how it related to the culture. And so that is a way of, for me, that is the way of decolonizing through design, meaning that colonization is intended to, it builds boundaries, right? It's a thing that builds boundaries and then pits us against one another and says, well, we're inside, you're outside, it's us, it's them. And so when we begin to do that, that's when we should be aware of how can we not see those boundaries and how do we begin to pull them down. So
because architecture has those same abilities to draw boundaries, yep, to draw lines, to draw structures that keep people out or in.
Right, right. That's what it's intended to do. But I think that if we begin to think about in a conceptual way, how can we get rid of those lines? How can we begin to blur those lines? Or how can we make those lines be fluid and open so that there is some translation or ways of getting across and back and forth across those boundaries?
How was it received by your students? What were some of their questions like?
Well, they really like dug into the topic. I was really really satisfied with the work, and I was really enthused by the ways that they tackled it. So I created a sort of reading list to help them understand. But partway through the semester, what I realized was they didn't really know any kind of Indigenous history or Indigenous policies, that why reservations exist and how do people exist within them? And what does home ownership mean on a reservation and how is it different? And what I also realized was it wasn't really their fault. Their K-12 education, their undergraduate education didn't explain this to them and didn't begin to talk about how Indigenous people ended up in these situations, contemporary situations where we are talking about housing for Indigenous people. They, I think, really tackled the topic. And while we weren't looking for very specific solutions, what I was looking for were ways of thinking about how we would begin to do this. And that I think was very successful in the studio.
Architect and Professor Chris Cornelius with us, working to raise the visibility of Native voices in the profession, promoting Native sovereignty. What should we be teaching young students of architecture? Are you an architect or a designer? Maybe years in the field? Do you find inspiration in the land, in nature, in storytelling? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Cornelius here on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. We're in conversation with architect and educator Chris Cornelius, a citizen of the United Nations, learning how Indigenous storytelling and mythology inform how he approaches design and the values he's instilling in architecture students, and about what effect their structures will have on the natural world as long as they're there. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Milwaukee architect Chris Cornelius with us for about 9 more minutes. Chris, I want to talk about empathy, because you've been bringing up empathy as you see it in colonization, and also that there's a lack of it. How does empathy tie into architecture?
Well, I think that, you know, the one thing that colonization feeds off of is this lack of empathy. If we're not thinking about one another, then it's easy for us to be able to separate and build boundaries and to take land and conquer peoples and other sorts of things. So I feel like as an educator, what I'm trying to do is to, how can I start to build that empathy, and not just for one another as human beings, but for our non-human relatives as well. How can we start to make architecture and buildings that are habitats? We do in the discipline, we spend a lot of time trying to keep birds off of our buildings, for instance. And what if it was a habitat? What if it was a habitat for pollinators? Because these are the things that we need in the world. And so I begin to do that through being able to teach design studios that might be in areas of the city. For instance, when I was teaching here, areas of the city that these students might not go to, in African-American neighborhoods and Latinx neighborhoods. I taught one studio that was about hip hop. And so seeing hip hop as a culture, and how do we begin to see that? And all of these things are, I'm using the same methodologies that I've developed in my own work for Indigenous people. Can I begin to teach these methodologies to students, and so that they can begin to see how architecture affects people? Because I think in architecture school, we've been very good at teaching students the how and the what. Like, this is the kind of building you're going to make, and this is how you make it. But we haven't been having very distinct discussions about the who and the why. Who are we making this for? And how do we serve them? And how is this particular piece of architecture going to serve those communities? And so it's in that sort of, through that lens, that I want to begin to, for students to be able to see themselves as part of that empathetic network.
I'm wondering,
begin to think about it that way. Yeah,
I'm wondering, when you teach students and you explore other cultures and go into other neighborhoods that might they have never experienced before, do you ever take students to a reservation?
I have not. And unfortunately, the Yale studio happened during the pandemic, and so we were working in a community in Manitoba. The original plan was for us to travel to that reservation, but I haven't had that experience yet. But I certainly will at some point.
Yeah, what architects give you inspiration? Who do you look for, you know, for inspiration?
Well, there are historic examples, like in the sort of big history of architecture, and I, like a lot of architects, I look at Le Corbusier. I look at Carlo Scarpa, just because they make beautiful things. And, you know, as a designer, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm unapologetically trying to make beautiful things, because I think that whether people understand the culture or the context or whatever else, they just want to exist within beautiful architecture. But contemporary architects, I look at people like David Adjaye, who's an African architect, and is working all over the world, and someone like Francis Carré, who's also an African architect who was educated in Berlin. His office is based in Berlin, but he's doing work in his community. And I had the fortunate experience of being able to work with him, because he came to UWM to teach a studio, and I was co-teaching it with him. But those are people that are they're also regarded within the entire discipline. And so that's important to me as well, that that the discipline, in order to have these conversations, I have to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And I can't just be a sort of subset or some sort of subgenre. Like, Indigenous architecture shouldn't just be a kind of thing that's on the side that people may or may not be interested in. But I want to have larger disciplinary conversations about how Indigenous knowledge can be used in architecture.
So if you can imagine a future where you've succeeded in this of decolonizing architecture and the architecture field, what does that look like? How does that translate?
There are open dialogues between Indigenous people and architecture and in the landscape, right? Like, the, even the things that we're calling sustainability or environmental responsive architecture, Indigenous knowledge is intended to be able to be shared. And it's not just for Indigenous people. That's, this is my belief. It, but it has particular resonance with Indigenous people. And so as we see ourselves as stewards of the landscape, you know, it's not that forest fires didn't exist 10,000 years ago. Indigenous people just had ways of foresting that helped control those things. Or mm-hmm. flooding still existed. How do you begin to think about how do you react to those things? Those knowledge sources are ones where it would be openly shared. And for me, the architecture schools would be participants in that knowledge sharing, meaning if we're intervening in this landscape, meaning the United States, we would understand the policies, we would understand the history of the landscape that we're intervening in, and architecture students would also learn that in the process of learning about architecture.
Yeah. In the last few moments, you mentioned forest fires, and you have a fire circle at UW-Milwaukee that was completed earlier this year. Can you acquaint us with the fire circle and what it means?
Sure. It's about to be completed.
We're about to be. Yeah.
Yep. It's about to be installed. And so our fabricators are working on it, but it's intended for Indigenous students and staff, teachers to use in the ceremonies that throughout the year for fires, but it's really open to anyone. And so it's intended to be inclusive in that way, to be very specifically addressing Indigenous students at UW-Milwaukee. And so that they see themselves, they're an important part of the university. I'm an alum. I went to UWM, mm-hmm. And so it's always been a part of my trajectory. And it's a place of gathering, really intended for everyone. So we're looking forward to installing that and for that to be in use by the end of the fall here.
Chris, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Chris Cornelius of Milwaukee, recently named chair of the Department of Architecture at the University of New Mexico School of Architecture and Planning, a citizen of the United Nation of Wisconsin and founding principal of Studio Indigenous. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.